headlines, Russia says it's clear that U.S. President Joe Biden does not want to get the relationship between Washington and Moscow back on track. A leaked U.S. memo details plans by the administration of President Joe Biden to reset ties with the Palestinian Authority. And also in our headlines, a U.N. report warns about COVID-19 lasting economic consequences and calls for continued global efforts to counter the disease. Hello and welcome everybody. Here in the Iranian capital, Tehran, this is World News. Our top story for this half hour, the Kremlin says the new U.S. administration has no interest in improving its strained relations with Moscow after President Joe Biden likened his Russian counterpart Vladimir Putin to a killer. Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov called Biden's statements very bad. He said such remarks show that Washington doesn't want to get its ties with Moscow back on track. Russian parliament members also called Biden's comments unacceptable at a watershed moment in the relations between the two countries. On Wednesday, Biden described Putin as a killer, adding that he will pay the price for meddling in the U.S. election. The remarks followed an American intelligence report claiming that Putin had directed efforts to swing the U.S. presidential race in favor of Donald Trump. The United States says both pressure and diplomatic options are on the table for dealing with North Korea.
President Biden plans to complete a North Korea policy review in the weeks ahead in close coordination and consultation with the Republic of Korea, with Japan, with other key partners, including reviewing pressure options and potential for future diplomacy.
Blinken also stressed the U.S. commitment to the denuclearization of North Korea. He made the remarks in a joint briefing with South Korean officials in Seoul. This comes shortly after a senior North Korean diplomat rejected any talks with the U.S. until Washington withdraws its hostile policies towards Pyongyang. Cho Sun-hui said Pyongyang has only heard, quote, lunatic theory of threats from the new U.S. administration. Former U.S. President Donald Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un met twice in 2019 for talks, but the negotiations failed as Washington refused to relieve any sanctions in return for Pyongyang's goodwill measures. Political commentator Timothy Kurzweil says Washington's track record has made it unreliable for North Korean officials.
What it means to deal with North Korea. I mean, the notion that you're dealing with a sovereign state is an interesting position to take for goodwill negotiations like the one that they're supposed to be proposing, isn't it? I think it's likely that this whole issue is going to not really go anywhere. I mean, from the perspective of the DPRK, why would you want to negotiate with the United States, a country, while it's doing what it's doing? I mean, it's seen the track record in the past. You know, the Libya gets disarmed and then regime changed and overthrown. Iran enters into a deal with the United States about its nuclear program, and its top generals and nuclear scientists get assassinated. Without the United States withdrawing the pressure that it's already applying, what's in it for the DPRK to enter into any kind of negotiation with the United States? It just doesn't make much sense.
China has warned the U.S. that it will not make any compromise on its sovereignty and security ahead of talks between the two countries. Foreign Ministry spokesman Zhao Lijian urged Washington to stop talking tough and engaging in, quote, megaphone diplomacy towards Beijing. He said the U.S. should meet China halfway and conduct the dialogue in a sincere and constructive manner. On Wednesday, Washington said it intends to show its firmness against Beijing. Secretary of State Antony Blinken and the White House National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan are set to meet with senior Chinese official Yang Jiechi and Foreign Minister Wang Yi in Alaska. It's the highest level face-to-face diplomatic meeting between the two countries since U.S. President Joe Biden took office. The new U.S. administration is reportedly planning to review Washington's policies toward the Israeli occupation of Palestine. A memo revealed to an Arab daily says the Biden administration will push for a two-state solution based on the pre-1967 lines with mutually agreed land swaps. The memo shows the United States is planning to announce a $15 million aid package for Palestinians to deal with the coronavirus pandemic. Washington also plans to roll back some policies such as U.S. legitimizing of Israeli settlement activities in the occupied territories. The previous U.S. administration under President Donald Trump had given a green light to Israel to embark on its agenda, including settlement constructions. Washington also relocated its embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem al-Quds, in a move that sparked international outcry. Analyst Mick Napier believes that U.S. President Joe Biden seeks to strengthen Washington's alliance with Israel.
Biden will be much more cunning, he'll be much more strategic, and he will strengthen the U.S. alliance with Israel. America will grumble, will complain sometimes, but we know that this two-state solution and some future land swap simply means they can continue to dispossess the Palestinian people. And it underlines the fact that this is a strategic, deep alliance which has weathered many storms since 1967. Actually, I think America's ties to Israel will become stronger because it will delegate, it will subcontract the disciplining of states that America wants disciplined and subcontract the support for very unstable states like the Emirates and Saudi Arabia while America looks elsewhere. So the situation for the Palestinians looks as dire as it ever has done, paradoxically because of American weakness and therefore a greater reliance on its settler colonial project in the Middle East, Israel.
Iran's Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif says the pressure imposed on the Iranian nation has failed to bring Tehran to its knees.
Over the past year, we have once again shown our ironclad resilience. From confronting economic terrorism, targeting our access to food and medicine in order to bring us to our knees, to standing up to modern-day state terrorists who murdered the pioneers of our defense and scientific advancement. And all of this amid the deadliest pandemic humanity has seen in a century.
In his message congratulating the Persian New Year, Zarif said Iranian people have endured unjust suffering on a massive scale over the past years. He, however, said that Iranians are now stronger and determined more than ever to decide their own destiny. He noted that Iran's economy is becoming immunized against outside coercion, with industrial production leading the country's growth. Zarif expressed Iran's willing to expand engagement with its neighbors and beyond for building a better world. The International Atomic Energy Agency says it has confirmed that Iran has been operating a cascade of advanced centrifuges at an underground site. IAEA Director General Rafael Grossi told member delegations that Iran has, quote, begun feeding a newly installed cascade of 174 IR-4 centrifuges. He said the installation in the pilot fuel enrichment plant near Natanz is aimed at enriching uranium hexafluoride gas up to 5% U-235 uranium. According to Grossi, Iran has also indicated it plans to install a second cascade in the Natanz facility. There have been no comments from Tehran yet on Grossi's remarks. Britain has announced its plan to increase its nuclear weapons stockpile by over 40%. The UK has justified the move by claiming it merely wants to defend itself against increased security threats. That's why campaigners and politicians have criticized the plan, saying it amounts to a violation of the Non-Proliferation Treaty and international law.
The British Prime Minister Boris Johnson unveiled the UK's plan to expand its nuclear warhead stockpile by at least 40%. He justified the move by claiming that it merely aims to ensure Britain's security in a more risky global environment as it faces technological and doctrinal threats. The decision would end Britain's gradual nuclear disarmament program, as London had been committed to cutting its nuclear stockpile to 180 warheads by the mid-2020s. On March 16, the British government released a long-awaited review of defense, security, and foreign policy. A key piece of the document centered on the strengthening of the UK's nuclear deterrence, and as widely reported, the government plans to increase the cap on the stockpile of nuclear warheads from 180 to 260. The review also noted that Britain reserves the right to withdraw assurances that it will not use nuclear weapons against a non-nuclear armed state. The announcement prompted British campaigners to slam the UK government's plan to increase the country's nuclear weapons stockpile, which was described as a move that amounts to a violation of international law. The planned increase also drew criticism from the Labour Party leader, Keir Starmer. He accused the Tory government of having a global reputation for breaking international law. Also, the Scottish National Party defense spokesperson, Stuart MacDonald, slammed the increase as nothing short of abhorrent. The decision also prompted international outcry. The Kremlin slammed the decision, saying that it harms international stability and strategic security. Russia also stressed that the presence of nuclear warheads threatens global peace.
Well, Britain had earlier announced it's going to spend over $100 billion on modernizing its military to prepare them for future wars. Now it's planning to expand its nuclear arsenal and act against its commitments as a signatory of the NPT. Meanwhile, the U.S. also plans to build new $100 billion nuclear missiles. That's while both countries have repeatedly accused Iran of militarizing its peaceful nuclear program.
While Boris Johnson defends his government's plan to expand Britain's stockpile of nuclear warheads, he's accused Iran of attempting to acquire a nuclear weapon. Following those remarks, Iran's Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif lambasted the UK's hypocritical behavior and said, unlike the UK and its allies, Iran believes nukes and all weapons of mass destructions are barbaric and must be eradicated. Iran has time and again rejected as baseless the West's claim that it is seeking a nuclear weapon. Such allegations also run counter to numerous reports by the International Atomic Energy Agency, showing the peaceful nature of Iran's nuclear program. The IAEA has carried out intense inspections of Iran's nuclear sites over the past several years. On the other hand, the United States possesses nearly 6,000 nuclear warheads and is planning to build a new $100 billion nuclear missile. Washington has repeatedly accused Iran of militarizing its peaceful nuclear program and has even imposed illegal and inhumane sanctions against Tehran to hamper its nuclear development.
There is no accident here whatsoever. The fact of the matter is that the UK claims that its nuclear weapon system is an independent, sovereign nuclear weapon system, when in fact it is wholly and entirely reliant on the United States of America. The one element of the UK's nuclear weapon system which is not wholly reliant, or which they claim is not wholly reliant on the United States, is the nuclear warhead itself.
Both London and Washington are showing a hypocritical behavior regarding their nuclear programs. While they both are developing this technology for military dominance, why don't they let other countries, like Iran, have it for peaceful purposes?
The UN Conference on Trade and Development says the COVID-19 pandemic will have lasting economic consequences. In a report, the UN body said there was a 3.9% drop in output last year as the spread of the coronavirus sparked lockdowns across the world. It called the impact exorbitant, describing the destruction of income on an unprecedented scale, with people in developing countries particularly harder hit. It said the crisis is still very serious and the recovery is not over. The report called for continued government support. It said the crisis would have been worse had central banks not taken preemptive actions to avoid financial meltdown. Political commentator Rodney Shakespeare says the world economy was already in a bad situation before the outbreak of COVID-19, and the coronavirus has made the situation even worse.
This is not a good faith warning. It's a bad faith warning, pointing out that the situation was very bad beforehand, and that when, at some stage in the future, there's going to be a great big crash, they are going to blame it all on the coronavirus, and they're not looking at the structural failures, which have been there long before 2008. And I just remind you that debt levels are now higher than what they were in 2008. Well, you see, they're not actually addressing the problem of the economy, except by printing fantastic amounts of printed money, which keeps the party going for a bit longer, but doesn't solve the underlying problem. The virus undoubtedly is very, very bad, and they've just swindled money at it. But none of that has actually corrected structural problems.
Five people have been killed and over a dozen others injured in a roadside bomb explosion in the Afghan capital, Kabul. The blast came hours before Russia-sponsored P-8 peace talk on Afghanistan in Moscow. Our correspondent in Kabul, Aminolami, joined us earlier to give us more details on the incident.
The Kabul residents began their day once again with a huge explosion. This time, this incident happened in the northern part of this city. According to Kabul police, a magnetic bomb blast has hit a minibus carrying the employees of Afghanistan's communication ministry. This incident has happened in Police District 17 in Khairkhana area. However, none of terrorist groups, including the Taliban or Daesh, has claimed responsibility for this incident. In the meantime, Afghanistan's Interior Ministry says that a wide-range operation is underway across big cities of Afghanistan, mainly here in the Afghan capital, Kabul, to find the main sources of the launchers of such attacks. However, Afghanistan's National Directorate of Security also says that the Taliban militant group is behind launching such attacks that claims the lives of civilian employees of the Afghan government, not only those people, but also rural Afghans, mainly women and children, are being killed on a daily basis as a result of rising violence and bloodshed.
There's no end in sight to the sufferings of thousands of missing citizens in Pakistan. The systematic and forced disappearances started after Islamabad joined the so-called U.S. War on Terror 20 years ago. Javed Rana has more from Islamabad.
These are helpless parents in this protest held in Pakistan's capital, Islamabad. They have a tragic story which they say no one is willing to listen in Pakistan. Their two sons, one after the other, disappeared. One of them disappeared 7 years ago, while the another one just last week. They have no clue about the whereabouts of their sons. This is just tip of the iceberg of the tragedy of the victims of thousands of similar cases of enforced disappearances. It all started in late 2001 when the US-led NATO forces invaded neighboring Afghanistan and Islamabad joined their so-called war on terror. Pakistan's secret services have been at the heart of allegations to have illegally detained citizens under the cover of so-called war on terror. A significant number among the detained citizens were allegedly secretly handed over to the U.S. The repeated demands of the victim families to either prosecute their loved ones or set them free have gone unheard in Pakistan. Despite promises to set them free, the successive civilian governments and judiciary have done little to help the victim families. The country's military-run secret services have mostly defied the orders of Pakistan's superior courts to release the missing citizens, languishing in jail for years, some of them well over a decade without any charge sheet.
In a controversial move, Pakistan's parliament provided blanket immunity to the secret services in 2014 from prosecution on the charges of illegal detention, torture, and killing of citizens. Nonetheless, this did not bring any significant let-up in enforced disappearances in Pakistan. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
And that brings us to an end here on this edition of the World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of a speech delivered on February 22, 2021 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the chairman and members of the Assembly of Experts. The meeting was held at the end of the 8th session of the Assembly.
در مطلب اول یکی از نیازهایی که همه جوامع اسلامی و همه کشورهای اسلامی مورد ابتلاشون هست و به اون نیاز دارند به خصوص کشور عزیز ما که به حمدالله با نظام اسلامی اداره می شود
As for the first issue, one of the needs that all Islamic societies and countries have, in particular our dear country which is thankfully run by an Islamic government, is to put Islamic concepts into practice. The epistemological and ideological system of Islam is a set of concepts that should be introduced to the people and brought to the arena of action. This is a very great and important task. Whenever we put an Islamic concept into practice, I will briefly explain this matter later on, it proved to be valuable to the nation and to the country in terms of earning reputation for Islam and the Islamic Republic. And whenever we showed negligence, we deprived ourselves of very good things.
Your light and love, all I see, nothing more I'd ever want to need. My Lord, protect me from dishonor. Grant me faith to be stronger.
در واقع عرضه بنده این است که عناوین و مفاهیم معرفتی اسلام جنبه عملیاتی ترجمه عملیاتی پیدا کنه.
What I want to say is that the ideological concepts of Islam should be given an operational aspect and implementing these concepts should become common practice. But this will not happen on its own and it requires hard work. I will cite three examples in this regard.
مثلا فرض فرمایید حالا در همین قضیه اخیر کرونا.
For example, on the issue of the coronavirus, the concept of muwasat, assisting others, is a key concept in the ideological and epistemological system of Islam. With a little clarification and promotion, this concept brought about a movement in society, the movement of offering pious help through which a great endeavor was made. In other words, the people put muwasat, a valid religious concept and idea, into practice. You witnessed how much work was done throughout the country and how many values were created thanks to the work done by the youth, the people, various groups, governmental organizations, and revolutionary associations. A good endeavor was made and a good movement was launched which untied certain knots and accomplished certain tasks. In other words, the concept of Muwasat had the magnetism and the capacity to influence society in such a magnificent manner.
Alhamdulillah, Alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah.
Praises to Allah.
filing submitted by the British law firm called Speeches where the Syrian First Lady praises the mothers of Syrian soldiers killed on the front line. It also points to interviews where she supports her husband and soldiers for defending their homeland. The law firm says the evidence compiled, in our view, legally speaking, far exceeds what may be considered reasonable comment or mere propaganda and amount to the incitement, encouragement, and or aiding and abetting of war crimes and crimes against humanity. Again, analysts question why there has been no investigation for a single politician whose country has committed war crimes, such as leaders and officials in the US or the UK and France.
The West takes it upon itself that they can attack and invade countries at will, and everything they do is justified, even if it's based on fabricated evidence, like the weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, and of course the attack on Syria. This is, the United States, even under Obama, which was much better, was illegally invading countries. There was no justification, no resolution from the UN Security Council, and it was pure hypocrisy that Syria represented a threat to the United States, or this is a defensive war.
The timing of this move raises further question marks. On Monday, the UK had imposed new sanctions on six Syrian government officials, including the country's foreign minister. Now that the fighting has subsided in Syria and government forces have the upper hand against terror groups, any military plots to overthrow the government appear to have failed. Could the West be looking at new ideas to destabilize the country? Syria faces fresh problems today, including the spread of the coronavirus and the state of its economy. American forces are occupying the country's east, where the oil reserves are, thereby preventing Damascus from using its oil revenue to rebuild vital infrastructure. The US and Israel continue to launch airstrikes. Syria also accuses the European Union of being responsible for the suffering and bloodshed of civilians, saying the bloc, along with Britain, has backed terrorist groups. Yet, civilians are starting to return to many liberated parts of their homeland, including entire provinces that had been destroyed by various terror groups. Researchers say since March 2011, Washington has led a coalition of NATO countries, Arab monarchies, and Israel in a proxy regime change war using terrorist mercenaries as foot soldiers. Perhaps a wider investigation is needed to establish who supported the terrorists, who funded them, who backed them, who provided them with training, and who really committed war crimes in the Arab country. Britain's Metropolitan Police have opened a preliminary investigation into the wife of Syria's First Lady, Asma al-Assad. A London-based law firm has filed a complaint over allegations of incitement and encouragement to commit acts of terrorism. Asma has dual British-Syrian nationality and could reportedly lose her British citizenship and have an international arrest warrant issued if convicted. The Metropolitan Police say it received a referral in July last year relating to the ongoing Syrian conflict. In a statement, the Met says the referral is in the process of being assessed by officers from the War Crimes Unit. British media suggests police are considering whether there is enough evidence to carry out a full investigation. This is why analysts say there is sufficient evidence to investigate former British Prime Minister Tony Blair for his leading role in the invasion of Iraq.
A total double standard. Actually, Tony Blair admitted that that George Bush was fabricating evidence against Syria. For the war, of course, Blair has been invading a country. There's no legitimate reason for that. Plus, American troops are there at the present time, and British troops are actually even in Syria and French troops for a very long period of time, which does constitute a war crime.
As a result of the invasion of Iraq, hundreds of thousands of civilians have been killed. The invasion also led to the birth of terrorist groups that had no presence in the country before. These terrorists, including Al-Qaeda and Daesh, have killed and raped locals on a mass scale and ravaged the entire country. Yet the perpetrators of the invasion and its aftermath continue to live a lavish lifestyle. On the other hand, Asma al-Assad has suffered from cancer and has paid a considerable amount being treated for the disease, which raises questions over her role in the alleged crimes committed.
The
The COVID-19 pandemic has been negatively affecting minorities in the UK, especially the British Muslims. The coronavirus outbreak has caused hardships for a record number of Muslims in the country, with the faith group experiencing a fall into poverty at a much higher rate than the rest of the British population. Also, the demand for help among them has doubled within a year. According to the National Zakat Foundation and Islamic Relief UK, requests for financial help have risen from about 15 per day before the first lockdown measures were introduced in the country to over 70 per day toward the end of 2020. The National Zakat Foundation says it has offered £3.8 million in grants. The figure represented a 27% increase compared to the previous year. The charitable organization offers such grants from Zakat, the obligatory religious levy collected from British Muslims.
Day in, day out, Muslims are being attacked on media by politicians of all persuasion, you know, left, right, every aspect of their lives is being associated with terrorism, with negativity, and this has an impact. I mean, this will have impact both financially and psychologically on the Muslim community. Even Muslim organizations are not really adhered or supported.
With the second Ramadan and lockdown fest approaching, the national charity says funds are still urgently needed to respond to the continuing high demand for help. With the vast majority of Zakat typically given during Ramadan, the National Zakat Foundation is now urgently seeking funds to ensure they can meet the needs of the community in the weeks and months ahead. Figures from the Muslim Census Organization reveal the community has been falling into poverty at a rate 10 times higher than the UK population. The report also revealed that job losses among British Muslims have been 6 times greater compared to the rest of the population since the pandemic began. It also showed that 42% of Muslims surveyed had used their savings to cover their expenses during the pandemic. This is compared to a recent study by AJ Bell, an investment company, which recorded that 30% of UK people have had to use their savings. As well as facing poverty, Muslim communities are especially vulnerable to coronavirus, as many live in extended households where elderly people and those with existing health conditions are most at risk. Key workers such as NHS staff and transport workers from these families also have the additional fear of catching the virus. But there are other factors involved, including health inequalities.
Muslims, due to Islamophobia, and they have become second-class citizens in their own countries, in Britain, France, Germany, and most of the Western world. And they are being discriminated. They are the first one to be fired, they are the last one to be hired.
Experts believe the problem with the UK's health system is that people aren't getting the information and support they need.
It's not something that is just happening last week or last month. It's been going on for a very long time and nothing is being done about it. Governments, not only they're not making an attempt to stop it, they are, them themselves and the politicians are actually contributing to ever-increasing sort of environment of hate against Muslims.
They say, as the pandemic comes to an end, the British government needs to reinvest in services that support people's health and ensure they're culturally and linguistically inclusive and accessible to people from all communities.
A group of 17 countries have united in defense of the United Nations Charter. The group seeks to form a coalition to promote multilateralism and counter the use or the threat of force and sanctions against other UN member states. The coalition, known as the Group of Friends in Defense of the Charter of the United Nations, includes Iran, China, Russia, Palestine, Syria, Venezuela, North Korea, and Cuba, as well as several other countries. The group has called for dialogue, tolerance, and solidarity, and these are the core of international relations and vital for the peaceful coexistence among nations. The group's concept notes said unprecedented attacks against multilateralism have put the global peace and security in jeopardy, adding that imposition of coercive measures and the withdrawal from global agreements were signs of growing unilateralism. That is while all 17 members of the group were under sanctions during the former U.S. President Donald Trump's time in office. For instance, the Trump administration imposed sanctions against Iran over its peaceful nuclear program, China over alleged technology theft, and Russia over the 2014 integration of Crimea. Under Trump, Washington announced plans to quit the World Health Organization, pulled out of the UN Human Rights Council, the UN cultural agency UNESCO, the Paris Climate Change Accord, and the 2015 Iran nuclear deal. Trump's successor, Joe Biden, has pledged to reverse Washington's previous course as he rescinded the withdrawal from the World Health Organization and returned the U.S. to the Paris Climate Change Agreement. However, Biden has maintained the sanctions already in place against Iran, as well as against Cuba, Venezuela, North Korea, Syria, and other countries involved in the 17-party group of friends, proving that Washington has no plans to put an end to its hostile and illegal sanctions.
I think it's a very significant move. The United States announced after President Biden's inauguration that we were back on the world scene. And I think expected that everybody would make a sigh of relief and everything would be fine. But I don't think that's quite what's happened here. The Chinese and the Russians and, 17 other nations or more have signed this declaration to work through the United Nations to end the kind of unilateralism, unilateral interference in foreign affairs. Clearly, that's aimed at the United States.
Members of the Group of Friends Coalition have railed against Washington's sanctions and intervention in various statements. A good example of Washington's unilateralism is its withdrawal from the 2015 Iran nuclear deal. The U.S. left the deal unilaterally and rescinded hundreds of sanctions against Tehran. Since the U.N. Security Council Resolution 1737 was passed in 2006, the U.S. and the European Union have been the biggest supporters of sanctions against Iran in order to hamper its peaceful nuclear program. They have both passed numerous bills to impose ever harsher sanctions, including Washington's failed maximum pressure campaign. Last month, Iran's foreign minister, Mohammad Javad Zarif, said the U.S. sanctions against Iran have inflicted the country's economy with $1 trillion worth of damage. China has repeatedly called on the U.S. to stop its illegal unilateral sanctions on Iran. Meanwhile, Russia has slammed the anti-Iran sanctions by Washington, calling them anti-human. However, despite being a failed policy, Washington continues its futile approach. According to the report published by the Cost of War Project at Brown University's Watson Institute and USA Today, the U.S. military has been in over 85 countries in the past 3 years. U.S. troops have conducted bombing or ground attacks in 10 countries, including Afghanistan, Yemen, Syria, Iraq, Kenya, Libya, Mali, Nigeria, Pakistan, and Somalia over the same period.
After all, if we talk about the Middle East, it was the United States who withdrew from the nuclear accords. That's an act of hostility. And then to blame the Iranians and say, unless they do something, we're not going to come back. I mean, this is the kind of double standard we face. And it is one that's going to have to be overcome politically in this country before there's going to be a change.
A recent report by the Washington Post revealed that the U.S. has attempted to change other nations' governments 72 times between the years 1947 and 1989 during the Cold War. Finally, when the U.S. continues to apply sanctions for its own political gains and gets away with it, or when the Israeli regime breaks the most U.N. resolutions, essentially making the resolutions ineffective, doesn't that put the UN institution's purpose under question?
The United States set to build a new nuclear missile dubbed Ground-Based Strategic Deterrent, GBSD, under a program for modernizing its nuclear stockpile. the $100 billion missile is expected to replace nuclear missiles, which have been operational since the 1960s. The new nuclear weapon under development would be able to travel nearly 10,000 kilometers, carrying a warhead more than 20 times more powerful than the atomic bomb dropped on Hiroshima. The U.S. Air Force is reportedly planning to order 600 of them. According to the U.S. Congressional Budget Office report, over the next decade, Washington will spend some $500 billion on its nuclear forces, which will translate into a whopping $1.5 to $2 trillion expenditure over the next 30 years.
There's no clear reason as to why the U.S. needs this hugely expensive modernization program, except that it has a lot of support in Congress, and the military-industrial complex always wants it. The U.S. Military machine is kind of a self-propelling mechanism. It just keeps, going on, getting bigger and bigger and spending more money, no one seems to know how to control it, even if they really want to control it.
Washington began its nuclear weapons modernization program under former U.S. President Barack Obama. His successor, former President Donald Trump, who made every effort to reverse Obama's legacy, embraced his stance on nuclear weapons. Trump doubled the number of America's low-yield nuclear weapons. In February 2020, the Pentagon said a new low-yield warhead was deployed on the USS Tennessee submarine patrolling in the Atlantic Ocean to deter, quote, potential adversaries like Russia. The United States withdrew from the Cold War-era intermediate-range nuclear forces treaty in April 2019, accusing Russia of violating the deal, something that Kremlin has denied. The INF treaty, reached with the Soviet Union in 1987, banned land-based missiles with a range of between 500 to 5,500 kilometers. With the treaty out of the way, the U.S. tested new missiles and made plans to renew its nuclear weapons tests. The U.S. shares the unaccountability with its closest allies, including Saudi Arabia and Israel, whose nuclear programs have been repeatedly slammed as non-transparent. Israel, the sole possessor of nuclear weapons in the Middle East, has tightly withheld information about its nuclear weapons program. It's estimated to be keeping some 100 nuclear warheads in its arsenal. Turning a deaf ear to international calls for nuclear transparency, the regime has so far refused, with the U.S. invariable support, to join the Non-Proliferation Treaty, NPT, that is aimed at preventing the spread of nuclear weapons. In the meantime, Saudi Arabia, which is a member of the NPT, has so far declined requests from International Atomic Energy Agency to inspect its nuclear sites. Despite this, the IAEA chief, Rafael Grossi, said in September last year that he believed Riyadh is after a peaceful nuclear program. But the approach toward other countries, including Iran, has been different. The U.S. withdrew from the 2015 nuclear deal with Tehran, dubbed the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, despite the IAEA's several reports from inspections that showed that Iran had been in full compliance with international accord.
The whole bargain that was the basis for the nuclear non-proliferation treaty was that the existing nuclear powers would wind down their nuclear arsenals in return for other countries not creating nuclear weapons of their own. So the U.S. Has adhered to neither of those principles. Both legs of that policy are being violated constantly. And U.S. Nuclear policy is in disarray, just as U.S. foreign policy in general is in disarray.
U.S. President Joe Biden is yet to take measures that would show his administration is willing to put an end to the double standard that is threatening the security of not only the region, but the whole world.
This is IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, welcome to another episode of Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Ayatollah Nasiri. Stay tuned. What does it mean when we say trust in Allah? This phrase is also mentioned in the Holy Quran. Trust in Allah means to leave all of our affairs to Allah, the Creator, and to let Him to be in charge of solving our problems and difficulties. This means that we consider Allah as the sole decider for our destiny and no one else. It means to regard Allah as the only reformer of all the affairs in this world. You, as a Muslim, must remember Allah and no one else in your life. Trust in Allah also means being aware of the fact that Allah is the only entity that can solve your problems. The mere belief in this fact is also important. We must not expect others to find solutions for our problems. This is the closest meaning of the phrase, trust in Allah. Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, for listening to this episode of Ulama Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Ayatollah Nasiri. Please do log into our website, which is parsetoday.com. And if you have any questions, comments, or suggestions, send an email to englishradio@irib.ir. Until next time, God bless you all, and may Allah be with you.
European News Bulletin.
Welcome back. My name is Amina Taylor, and we're broadcasting from the British capital. Now we cross the channel over to Paris because hundreds of demonstrators gathered outside the French Parliament in fresh protest against a controversial bill aimed at protecting the identity of police officers. Carrying placards and lighting flares, demonstrators chanted, "My camera against your baton." If passed into legislation, the contentious new bill, first introduced by the government of France's President Emmanuel Macron last year, would ban the showing of the faces of on-duty police officers with the aim of damaging their physical or psychological integrity. It would also give police more powers to use CCTV and drone footage. Critics of the bill say it will curtail press freedoms to report on police brutality. Well, Masoud Chajere from the Islamic Human Rights Commission is with us. Good to have you as always, Masoud. Do you feel France's police officers need more protection?
Well, the reality is what it seems very clearly is the protesters that needs protection. I mean, what we have seen over the demonstrations in last year's with the Yellow Vest, and we saw how police brutality was unleashed against ordinary people. Ordinary people were beaten up and so forth. And we know this, and we could prove this, and demonstrators could prove that because footage was made available. To actually deny that is basically saying that the police have got the right of hiding their abuses. So therefore you're promoting an authoritarian police state that police could get away with beating people and indeed even murder. And this is totally unacceptable. I mean, we know in other parts of the world, including Britain, the police themselves wore cameras. And those cameras and the footage is made available to make sure that everyone behaves adequately. And I think the more footage is available, both the demonstrators and indeed the police feel that they are being held accountable. And I think it helps to create a better atmosphere.
For everyone, indeed, Masoud. Well, We're just seeing here that weeks ago, France did the green light for a bill aimed at tackling so-called Islamic separatism within the country. Now they're having this debate about limiting press freedoms and what people can and cannot film. What do you make of Macron's government, their policies, and his attempts, some might say, to pander to potential right-wing supporters?
Absolutely. I think, unfortunately, it's not just France. But what we are seeing in France is those who are racist, those who are super nationalist, are getting the upper hand. And because of the atmosphere of environment of hate that has been created against Muslims and everyone else, politicians see the benefit of going towards extreme right as a means of getting more votes. And I think that this is really a dangerous sort of sleepwalking into fascism, which is being faced not just in France, but in Austria, in Switzerland, in Britain. You know, we got legislation going through the House of Commons right now, which actually sort of gives tremendous powers to the police when it comes to demonstrations, which if indeed was allowed in historically, then we wouldn't have a lot of freedoms which we have earned through campaigning and through advocacy and through sort of people actually taking active role in getting politically involved.
Indeed, Masoud.
Sorry.
We'll leave it right there. Thank you so very
Thank
much,
you.
As often. Right, so polls opened in cities across the Netherlands for the final day of voting in the country's general election. Now, opinion polls have put current Dutch Prime Minister Mark Rutte on track to secure a fourth term with an election victory that would put him on course to be the Netherlands' longest-serving government head. In spite of this, the next Dutch government is expected to be a coalition of at least four parties in the 150-seat parliament. The elections come amid a record rise in COVID-19 cases, a slow-paced vaccine rollout, and a collapsed coalition government. Voting is expected to be wrapped up later this evening. Now, Russia has rubbish claims of meddling in the 2020 U.S. presidential elections. A 15-page U.S. intelligence dossier released on Tuesday supported long-standing allegations that some of Trump's top lieutenants were playing into Moscow's hands by amplifying claims made against the Democratic candidate Joe Biden. The report said Moscow sought to push and influence narratives that included misleading or unsubstantiated claims against Biden. In a statement on their Facebook, Russia's U.S. Embassy in Washington